So I think with that, let me introduce Bob O from Littleton, Colorado.
Hi, my name is Bob Olson. I'm an alcoholic. It's by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I have not found a need or an excuse to take a drink today. Nor have I found a need or an excuse to take a drink since May 28th, 1973. Thank you, God. Thank you for inviting me. I have a special place in my heart for Texas. I've probably spoken more in Texas than anywhere else, and I'm always surprised and gratified by the enthusiasm and the warmth and the hospitality that you can find in Texas. Yesterday, when I was, it was yesterday morning, we were sort of sitting around out here in the hallway, and some of you know Big Book John out here from Albuquerque, and I'd met him some time ago, and it was the first chance I'd seen him in 8 or 9 years, and he asked me if I had gotten the obligatory tour of Amarillo yet, and I told him no, and he said, well, let's go take a look, and we went downtown, saw your tall building. Went to a truck stop, had chicken fried steak. And then we were coming back, and I was once again surprised by the friendliness and enthusiasm of the people of Texas. We were coming down Amarillo Boulevard. And there were ladies waving to us. I thought they were friends of John's. He told me he didn't know them. I suppose they were saying, welcome to Amarillo. I don't know. I'm a member of the Alcoholic Olsons from Madison, Wisconsin. We've been putting people in insane asylums and early graves for as long as we've been in this country, in every generation. The last one's my father. His name's Bob Olson, too. He lives at a place called the Grand Army Home in King, Wisconsin. He's paralyzed. He can't speak. And he is a victim of his alcoholism. When I was young, they used to compare me with him a lot. If I was doing something that displeased someone, they'd say, you're going to grow up and be a bum just like your dad. My family has a heritage of that. Our heritage is failure and alcoholism. When I grew up, I lived with four or five families. By the time I was 10 or 12 years old, and I don't really say that with it, for any particular reason other than to tell you that by the time I was 12 years old, I was pretty well shut off emotionally. I had made a decision in there that I wasn't going to let anybody get too close to me anymore, and I'm still trying to reverse that decision. I had a pretty normal kind of Olsen family. My dad was a physically abusive alcoholic. My mother was neurotic and suicidal. And when I did live with them, you were either ducking or trying to prevent one of them from killing somebody. When I was about 16, my mother had gotten married again. I was living with her and her new husband, who was another alcoholic. I had become a compulsive overachiever. I was a good student. I wanted to be all the success that my dad had never been. I wanted to be recognized, and I wanted to be good, and I wanted to be successful. One day I was on the football team, and I remember I was coming home one day, and I wanted to tell my mother that I had had some sort of success. I can't remember what it was. And I couldn't find her when I got home. I ran upstairs to see where she was, ran into her bedroom. And she was sitting in the bedroom with a 9mm pistol in her ear trying to kill herself. And I knew that the next thing I was going to see was about half her head going across the room. And she looked around when I came into the room and saw that I was there, and then turned back and tried to make the gun go off again. And that particular kind of weapon has a double safety system on it, and she just couldn't get it figured out. People, you know, I had a series of circumstances like that Alan bore you with, but people after that could never figure out whether I was trying to beat John Dillinger or Captain Marvel. When I was 17, I was vice president of the class. I was head of the Citizenship Club. I was head of the Luther League in my church. I started Junior Achievement in my hometown. I ran a gambling operation at a racetrack. And I was arrested for assault and sentenced to 2 years in the Green Bay State Reformatory, which I did not have to serve. But every Monday I had to go tell people that I was being nice and just sort of report in. I'm not an instant alcoholic. A lot of people had the experience of drinking one drink. I drank compulsively from the beginning, but it took a while. My first drinks were when I was probably 17 years old. Drank 3 cans of beer, threw all 3 of them up. Thought that was kind of stupid, and just went on about my business. I went through the Navy. Never got really too bent out of shape in the Navy. And came out, went to college, started getting in some trouble there, around finals usually. I went to the University of Wisconsin. I was in the top 3% at the University of Wisconsin scholastically. But I couldn't hold it together. I couldn't be in a room full of people. When they called my name, I couldn't raise my hand. I was in so much fear. I knew I didn't fit. I didn't know why. I just didn't feel good. I don't know whether the insanity, I don't know how that kind of insanity and alcohol react, except I know they react. I know when you finally figure out that when you pour alcohol on top of those kinds of feelings that it makes them go away, that something happens to you, because it happened to me. And when it happened to me, I couldn't stop drinking. But it took a while. I married a lady that I had met in the Navy, and we went off to become successful in business. It was kind of hard to get a job in Wisconsin at that point in time. I finally got a job as working for a loan company. And what they wanted was somebody to go out and collect bills. I wasn't quite sure of that. I thought I was going to make worldly decisions or do something like that, and they just wanted somebody out chasing people down for money. And so I went out and did that. And I thought, well, what the hell, it's a job. I'll go out and do it, and I'll be successful at it. And so I went out and I tried to be a diplomat. I think I weighed about 180 pounds. And I would go out and explain very carefully to people why it was necessary for them to pay back the bills, pay back money that they had borrowed from this loan company. And some of them thought that was quite funny. They would threaten me or throw me out or do things like that. And the first thing I did to take care of that was that I gained 50 pounds. I also found out that's kind of a nerve-wracking business, you know, to go out and talk to people about collecting money all the time. So I'd stop at the corner bar on the way home, and I would have what they up there call a beer and a bump. And so I'd sit there drinking shots and beers, and as soon as my motor was calmed down a little bit, I'd go home and talk to my wife. Um, something funny happens to me when I drink. My personality changes radically. I become abusive. I become all the things my father was. Thank God I never beat up my wife and I never beat up my kids, but I sure played hell with the people I was collecting money from. And I used to get home and I'd be all right pretty much being angry, and then I'd get up angry when I didn't have a drink and be restless, irritable, and discontented until I could once again find the bar. I'm going to try and get through all this drunk stuff in about 10 or 15 minutes so I can talk about recovery, so just bear with me. By the time I was 22 or 23 years old, I was probably the best collector in that state. I collected money all the way from the north side of Chicago to upper Michigan. I found out that the more I drank, the crazier I got. I got to the point where I'd just kick in people's doors and beat them up against the wall until they gave me the money. You don't like to have 240-pound psychopaths standing on your front door asking for money. It got to the point where it was so bad that there were guys that would get the hives when they saw me. There were women who would break into tears. I came to the attention of a group of people in Chicago who had me doing some work for them. And then they sent one of my friends, in fact, my best friend in high school, to come and see me. He had become a real roaring success also. He was a pimp in Chicago. And they came and he came and asked me if I would go to work for a man for this racetrack in Chicago that was run by the syndicate there. And I said, I told him I didn't know anything about running a racetrack. And he said, well, they don't want you to run the racetrack. They want you just walk around with the guy that runs the racetrack. And I said, well, why would they ask me to do that? And he said, because you're crazy. Do you know that? You're just crazy. You'd do anything they'd ask you to do. They'll put a gun in your hand, and that's the kind of guy they want. At the same time, I was president of the J.C.'s. President of the Optimist Club. I was voted one of the outstanding young men of the community. And I was on the governor's committee for mental health. Sometime after that, I went to work for a large paper company. They made me a manager of a paper converting plant in Minneapolis. I drank more and more. Eventually, I came back to Wisconsin. I was introduced to a whole lot of social people around the community. Some of them were doctors. And they gave me open-ended prescriptions for tranquilizers because I was so nervous. I was so nervous because I was on edge of DTs. And as a result of that, I found out that I could take that in the morning and I wouldn't have to drink. And I wouldn't have to shake. And I could wait till 3 o'clock in the afternoon to start drinking. So, besides drinking for near a bottle of booze every night, I took 30 to 50 milligrams of Librium every morning for 7 years. When I moved back to Wisconsin, I had gotten to the point where funny things started happening to my body. Sometimes Librium didn't work. I would get up in the morning and I would take a handful of that junk and I would go out to sell something for their converting plant, and I would get out in the middle of nowhere, and all of a sudden my body would start going into TTs, and everything would start wrenching, and I got to the point where you couldn't drive a car, and I'd pull over. The nice thing about Wisconsin is that there's a bar about every 150 yards, and I would run into this bar, and I would sit down and order a shot and a beer, and wait till a bartender turned the other way. You know, I could handle a glass of beer, but I couldn't handle a shot of booze. And I would try and get that into my mouth somehow. And, you know, you kind of lean down into it and turn over and get it all over everything and hope nobody's looking. Now I'd sit there and drink a shot and a beer and take Librium, drink a shot and a beer and take Librium, drink a shot and a beer and take Librium. And when I started feeling like I was human again, I'd go for home. I always thought that Al-Anon's invented shot glasses. That it would take somebody that was pretty mad at an alcoholic to put booze in something that size. I don't know how you felt about it, but when I was drinking, and one of the great things about being sober today is that I can eat soup with a spoon. You know, I don't shake so bad that everything falls out of stuff anymore. And shot glasses were like that to me. I just couldn't use them. You know, I'd drink whiskey out of a glass, but I just don't understand shot glasses. Let me just get all that stuff out of the way. In March of 1973, I started going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous periodically from 1968 on. I had gone there because I know there's a solution here. I knew that intuitively. You know, God talks to us through intuitive thought, and I knew for a fact that there was a solution here, and I just couldn't get to it. And the reason why I couldn't get to it was because I was always drunk or I was always stoned. And you can't come to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting all whacked out of shape and get anything out of it. You know, I used to go in Minnesota when I was up there. I would go into a meeting, and they'd go, I would sit in that meeting and go, God, I'm in so much trouble. I just don't know what to do. I mean, I can't stop drinking. I just can't stop anything. I'm falling apart. My nerves are gone. I don't know what I'm going to do. And they'd say, you're going to be all right. Okay? I don't tell people that. In the book, it says, talk about the fatal feature of the malady. You know, if somebody comes up and tells me that, I say, you're going to die. You're going to die, and if you're lucky, you'll go insane and die. Okay? Those are your choices. I've seen people in this program walk in the door, and everybody comes up and hugs them and pats them and strokes them, and that's what they're looking for. Sometimes you got to shout at them. Tell them, stop! Sometimes you can't talk to a drunk that way. Sometimes you can love them. Sometimes you just got to beat them over the head to get their attention. Otherwise, I'll wander off and die in a ditch someplace, just like we've been doing for as long as we've been drinking. I had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous in Wisconsin, and I had sort of picked up a sponsor. And he was trying to drag me around, get me to meetings, and one day I called him up and said, well, I don't really think I'm an alcoholic. And he said, okay, we'll probably see you again. And somewhere around the 28th of May, you know, it's a lot like Jesse. I don't know if that's the right day. I know that's either the right day or past the right day. Because I went on some kind of running drunk for about a week, and I wound up on the floor of an empty house in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. And a couple of people from Alcoholics Anonymous came in and carried me out. I don't even remember calling them. And after they found out that I was going to live, it was funny, I remember part of that. I remember when they came out there, and the guy who was my sponsor, who was this old Irishman, he came in there and he was trying to get orange juice and stuff in me because I was shaking so bad. And he had this guy with him that he took was taken on a 12-step call named Dick. And Dick had been sober maybe, months. And so he was out there all bright-eyed and, you know, wondering what the hell was going to happen. And they walked in there, and I'm shaking and doing all this stuff. And Leo's trying to pump orange juice and honey and stuff. I hope they don't do that anymore. That stuff is awful. And they're pumping this stuff in me, and Dick's going, oh, my God, is he going to die? Is he going to go into DTs? Is he going to go into convulsions? What's he going to do? And after they found out that I wasn't going to die on that particular occasion, they took me over and put me in front of a priest who was running a halfway house in that town, and they brought me down in front of him, and he asked me a very important question. The question is, are you an alcoholic? And I told him yes, and it was the first time I ever really understood it. The book says we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery, and then it says the delusion that we're like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. He asked me about that. Do I think I'm like everybody else? No. No, I'm not. I'm an alcoholic, and every time I drink, I do something tragic or bizarre or hurtful or mean, and I do it to the people that I love. I do it to the closest ones around me. Those are the ones that are available. You know, what does that mean to me today? Well, I'm 14 and a half years sober. And I'm going back through the work again today, and I do that almost every year. What does that mean to me today? Am I still powerless over alcohol? So in the book, it has descriptions of types of alcoholics. Talks about the heavy drinker. And I have to go back there and look and say, am I a heavy drinker? Heavy drinkers wind up in hospitals. Heavy drinkers wind up in broken relationships. Heavy drinkers wind up in automobile accidents. Heavy drinkers wind up in treatment centers. Am I a heavy drinker? You know, the differentiation between a heavy drinker and an alcoholic is that if there is a sufficient reason, a heavy drinker can stop. And there is absolutely nothing that would stop me. I don't care if everybody left. I don't care if I got fired. I don't care what. I don't care if it was going to kill me. I knew that. I went to a doctor in Minnesota one time and went in there and I said, I don't feel too well. And he said, so they did all these studies on me. And he said, well, I don't know what you're doing, but if you continue to do it, I'll guarantee you that you're going to, that 80%, you're going to have a stroke or a heart attack in the next 4 years. He said, you also have a liver like a football. And I thought, well, I don't think so. So I went across town to this other doctor, and I went through the whole battery tests all over again without telling him about the first guy. And this guy, after the test, came back and he said, I don't know what you're doing, but if you continue to do it, your chances of a heart attack or a stroke are 80% in the next 4 years. And I thought, he's been talking to that other side. It must be a conspiracy. So I looked at it. There's no sufficient reason to stop. They told me I was going to die. You know, I waited 5 years after that before I stopped drinking. And it wasn't because they told me I was going to die. You can't scare a drunk. So I looked at that. You know how we do the first step is that we start at the forward to the first edition and we read it. And every time it describes an alcoholic, my sponsor looked at me and he says, that sound like you. You know, it talks about all those things in the beginning of the third chapter that we do about taking trips and not taking trips. And I did most of that stuff. And he says, does that sound like you? You know, in the first part of that book, that's all it talks about. It's me. It's just talking about me. And I'll tell you where the great hope came from that. When my sponsor sat down with me and he showed me the forward to the first edition, and he said, read the part in the italics. And it says, to show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Okay? You know where the hope is in that? Precisely. That's where the hope is. If I went into an AA meeting after I had been in AA meetings for 5 years and some guy said, to show others, or in a general way, how we have recovered is the main purpose in this book, I know that I would have missed the point. But that says that someone can sit down and show me precisely how to recover. Do you believe that? It's true. It's absolutely true. And I have some hope from that because my sponsor said I can show you precisely how to recover. Well, that's kind of a lofty spiritual position to come from, isn't it? It's not really, because the book has precise directions in it. I sat there and read the first part of that book, and I was everything in there, and I know I'm not a heavy drinker. I'm a real alcoholic, and that means that every time I drink, I go out of control. I lose control. And then he took me back to the beginning of the one chapter where it says, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't drink entirely, or you can't quit entirely. And he said, does that talk about you? And I said, I think so. And he said, well, were you ever able to quit entirely? And I said, no, I once quit for a week. And he said, no, did you ever just quit and then you didn't ever do it anymore? And I said, no. And he said, well, you passed that part. And it says or. So I didn't even have to pass the second part. Or if once you start, you have little control over the amount you take. Does that sound like you? Yeah. I remember on the way home, or I'd say, I think I'll have a couple of drinks on the way home, and I get home the next day. You know, I'd go out for 2 drinks and have 20 drinks. I never could judge how many drinks I was going to take once I sat down and took a drink. And the book says that if that describes you, you're probably alcoholic. Bill Wilson had a way of writing that, so he didn't say you're definitely alcoholic. You know, he just wants you to make your own decisions. But if those things are going on in your life, you're probably alcoholic. And those things are going on in my life, then I am. And I have to look at that every time I go through the work. Well, I'm 14 and a half years sober. Am I a victim of the delusion that I can drink successfully? No. Every time I have drank, since I became compulsive and obsessive about drinking, I have been unsuccessful. There has never been a reversal. I have never drank successfully, and I have never seen anyone like me drink successfully. Every time I see someone in this program who loses sight of the direction and the thrust of this program and goes out and drinks again, they don't do it successfully. And I will not either. And I know that. My sponsor sat down with me on the second step and said, I want you to read this. If you are even willing to believe, upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Are you even willing to believe? You know, when I came to this program, I didn't believe in God. And this little guy in Wisconsin said, well, just kind of try and act like you do. Pray. You know, even if you don't believe it, just pray. And so I do that old business about praying in the morning to keep you sober and thank God at night for keeping you sober, and that's all I knew how to do. And that's what I did in the beginning. And my second step experience is this. I was sober 90 days, and I hadn't had a pill either. And I'm sitting there, and I'm really shaken and upset and disorganized, and my mind is going in 15 different directions at once. And he said, why are you sober? And I said, I don't know. I guess it's because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, that's bull. You hung around this program from 1968 until 73, and you never got sober. So hanging around AA is not the solution. What's different? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, are you eating differently? And I said, no. He said, are you exercising differently? And I said, no. Well, are you working harder? No. Well, what's different in your life? And I said, I'm doing the stuff you asked me to do. I'm praying in the morning and I'm praying in the evening. And he asked me, would you consider or would you concede that you are sober today by the grace of a God you don't even believe in. And it's true. Back a little further in that chapter, it says, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could neither postpone nor evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that God either is or he isn't. He's either everything or he's nothing. What's your decision to be? Okay? My self-imposed crisis is certainly my alcoholism, but it's more than that. My self-imposed crisis is that I can't fix myself. You know, if I could fix myself, I would have never come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, why the hell would I do that? I could have just done it at home, forgot the whole business. My problem is that I can't fix myself. And I'm crushed by this self-imposed crisis. You know, I'm not drunk because you made me a drunk. I'm a drunk because I drank. And I couldn't stop drinking. And I have that kind of system that reacts to alcohol like that. And I have that kind of personality that reacts to alcohol that way. I don't know why the hell that works, except I'm one. And so I can't fix it. The book says something real interesting. It says, no human power could relieve our alcoholism. Not good news. I can't fix myself, and you can't fix me. If I can't fix me and you can't fix me, who's going to fix me? The book says something very interesting there. It says, here we are squarely confronted with the issue of faith. Okay? You know why? Because if there isn't a God, there anybody else fixes. Going through the steps again, to what does that have to do with me today? About 8 or 9 months ago, there were a set of circumstances in my life which made it kind of difficult. And I'm going through that, and all of a sudden I feel like I'm running in molasses. And I'm trying to find in the book where it talks about that. And I got into the second step, and it started talking about people making heavy going out of life. And I went, whoops, I think this is where it is. I think I need to look at this more closely. And it describes two kinds of people there. It describes people who make heavy going out of life, and it talks about people who have power, peace, and a sense of direction. And that's what I didn't have. I didn't have power, I didn't have peace, and I didn't have a sense of direction. And it says that the difference between these people who make heavy going out of life and the people who have power, peace, and a sense of direction is the consciousness of the presence of God. Isn't that amazing? And how do I practice the consciousness of the presence of God? By understanding that I'm not running the show, that I'm the drunk. And when I started doing that, my life started changing again. You know, the thing that's been going through my mind for the last 2 days to get up here was to not talk about being drunk, to talk about being recovered, and that it was important that I do that for you, and it's a risk for me to do that because what I would normally try and do is get up here and entertain you, and I have no intention of doing that. The thing that's been going through my mind for the last 2 days is the spiritual life is not a theory. Okay? You have to live it. And if the spiritual life is not a theory and I have to live it, the only thing I know about spirituality are the steps of this program. And I will tell you that the problem has not changed. My alcoholism has not changed. And just as well, the solution has not changed. You know that my experience is that at 14 and a half years sober, I think about going back through the steps, and I think, why the hell should I have to do that? I mean, I've been doing that for all this time. And I've done it. You know, I mean, I've just done it ad nauseum. I mean, I've written inventories, and I don't like to write inventories. And I don't like to make amends. I don't like to go to people with my hat in my hand and tell them that I regret having done what I did and I'm willing to do anything to set the book straight. I just don't like to do it. But the spiritual life is not a theory. And someone asked me about 2 months ago if my life was really the way I wanted it to be. And I have to tell you right from the beginning that today, if I were to choose my life, it would be exactly the way it is. And this is the first time in my life within the last 2 years that I can remember that. Okay? If I wanted my life in a particular manner, I would live in the house I live in with the woman that I live with and work for the company I work for, and every other part of my life would be just exactly the way it is today. And it's a challenge, and I love it, and it's all because I had the willingness to practice this program, and I know that. I am dogmatic. I work steps as hard as anybody I know, and I go back and back and back and do it. And I know that everything that I have done for the last 14 and a half years has served absolutely no purpose except to show God that I was willing to participate. And everything that I have is a gift. When my sponsor, I want to talk about one thing about power. The second step, it talks about power. You know, you go into that book and it says, you know, you get a drunk and they go, my life's falling apart, my wife left me, I got fired from my job, I don't have any money, don't have any place to live, don't have a car, my clothes are falling off my back, I'm dirty, I need a shower, I don't know what the hell's going on. You say, tell me about the power in your life. Okay? Book says lack of power is our dilemma. Woo. That should be obvious. How are we to find such power? So that's what the book's about also. About finding a power greater than ourselves. If you read the book and you look about power, and I've never met a drunk that wasn't power hungry, including myself. First it says lack of power is our dilemma, and then it says we can find power in the book. And then it starts talking about the second step, and it says we find power, peace, and a sense of direction. Also talks about new power flowing in. And then it says whose power it is. It says that power which is God's. And then it says what you can do with it. It says, it's talking about people who laugh about funny things in meetings. It said, why shouldn't we? We have recovered, and we've been given the power to help others. Okay? There is not one place in that book that says, I have the power to help myself. It says, I have the power to help you. Not fix you, but help you. When we got into the third step, he showed me this business about selfishness, self-centeredness. That's the root of my problem. My problem is not the bottle. That's just a symptom. My problem is that I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, I'm resentful, I'm afraid, and if I deal with those things which seem to have absolutely nothing to do with my alcoholism, I don't have to drink anymore. And more importantly, I don't have to want to drink anymore. So they're saying, I know this looks like the problem, but attack that. Okay? And I did it. And everything you do in this program is an act of faith. So I went over and I started attacking this, and this started getting better. Talked about an actor. Here's this actor. He wants to run the whole show. And everybody just kind of goes over that. And it says, here's this actor who wants to handle the staging and the other actors and all the rest of this. And you know what people don't read? It doesn't say director there. It says actor. This guy could be some little bit part player, and he's telling everybody what to do. That's what he wants to do, and that's the perfect description of an alcoholic. It's the perfect description of me. You don't want to control everything around me. If you guys just stay where you are, this thing would work perfectly. My sponsor sat down with me and he said, I want you to read that third step prayer and I want you to consider it before you take it. And when you take it, I want you to understand what's going to happen, because when you make that decision, your life is going to change. And if anybody tells you anything differently, they're mistaken. But before you do that, understand it. And he sat down with me and went through, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. And he says that's anything that he will. That means he can strike you dead. He can give you AIDS. He can do anything he wants. He can take your children away from you. He can put you in China. He can go anywhere he wants. He can have you living in a cave for the rest of your life. He can have you successful in your own terms, but it's his choice. And if you did such a damn good job about your life, why would you not want him to get into the act? And so I sat there and considered it. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. You know, my bondage is not the bottle. My bondage is that I can't see you because I'm so busy looking at me. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy love, thy power, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. You know what bearing witness means? It means be an example. That's what it means. God's going to take away my difficulties, and he's going to let me be an example to you of what you can find in this program. Says after that, we thought well before making this decision, knowing that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. I don't know if any of you have ever been in the Navy, but abandon's a strong word for me. And abandoning self is like abandoning a ship. Okay, you get out of self and get away from it. My problem is that I am in self, and I need to abandon that. I need to abandon self to God. Let him take care of that. I don't have the strength to do that. And so I did that. I got on my knees and I held hands with another man. And I said the third step prayer and I meant it. You know what that is? It's like, are you sure you want God to be a part of your life? You're sure you want God to have all that power? Okay? What a joke. God's got all the power anyway. That's just an exercise in who's God and who's a drunk. Okay? You know what that whole thing does? It gets you centered. Here's God, and here's me. Okay? And I'm making this decision that God's going to start running my life. And God's going to speak to me through intuitive thought. And that's the way I'm going to hear it. And I'm going to do some stupid things thinking I'm hearing that. But eventually that will become a working part of my life. That's what the book says. God speaks to me through intuitive thought as much as he speaks to our groups through a group conscience. And he speaks to you the same way. Says that'll have little permanent effect, that decision, unless it's at once followed by a rigorous attempt to clean house. Big book's kind of interesting. You know, at once, followed by a rigorous attempt to clean house, and obviously they're talking about an inventory. Thing that kills me, you know, there's people come into Alcoholics Anonymous today, and they come in and they pat them on the back and tell them they're going to be fine. And guys say, well, I'm really kind of messed up. My mind doesn't work very well, and I think I just need to get well. And they can say, go, that's fine. Just do that. Hang around. Drink some coffee, eat some cookies, and 6 months from now when your mind is cleared up, maybe you can take a look at these spiritual principles. Strongest statement in the book. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. You know, there's no place in that book that says give these guys a 6 month sabbatical. There's a fly up here that's real fond of me. Well, at least I attracted flies. There's no place in the book that says take some time off. There's no place in between any of the 12 steps that says, okay, now rest up because that last one was tough. Okay? The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. So we launched into an inventory, and I wrote down this list of all these people, this grudge list. people that I had resentments against, why I was mad at them, what it affected, you know, my self-esteem, security, ambitions, personal and sex relations, fear. And I wrote because of this, because of that. And then it says you come back and you see where you were selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened in each one of those situations. And I did that. I got hung up on the fear inventory. It just says write down what it says. It says you write down the things you're afraid of, actually. So I said, my sponsor came up to me and he said, well, what are you afraid of? And I said, I don't think I'm afraid of anything. And he said, oh? That's not in keeping with what it says here. Actually, what it says here is fear is an evil and corroding thread, the fabric of our existence is shot through with it. And if I'm an alcoholic, you can bet your bottom dollar that the fabric of my existence is shot through with it. And so he said, well, how about snakes? And I said, what kind of snakes? And he said, well, like a rattlesnake. And I said, I wouldn't want to be in a closet with one. And he said, well, write down snakes. And he said, how about spiders? And I said, like black widow spiders? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay. He said, write down spiders. Well, how about women? You know, I always was just a little afraid of women. I'm just not going to qualify for this lady from California. Well, there goes my trip to Dana Point. And he said, well, I'll write down women. Well, how about little children? You know, I'm always afraid that if somebody, I don't like to hold a little tiny kid because I'm always afraid I'm going to squeeze them too hard or drop them or something. And I don't want to hurt them. And so he said, write down little children. How about failure? Oh, my God. Yeah, well, that's one of my heritages. Yeah, I'm afraid of failure. How about inadequacy? Yeah, I really never thought I was good enough for a lot of things. Was there anything you're not afraid of? I don't think so. There's an interesting comment there in the fear inventory. It says, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Yeah. Yeah. You know, left to my own devices with the absence of God that everything that was on my fear inventory I had every right to be afraid of. But if I turn that around and I say that I am standing in God's presence, what do I have to be afraid of? There's nothing to get through that. When I was going through that this time, I'm looking at it and I'm seeing a real incongruous statement, a paradox. Men of faith have courage. It's in the fear inventory. Why? Why would men of faith have courage? Men who have all this faith don't need courage. Okay? And why would I need it? If I have all this faith, I just have the faith to do what I need. I sure don't need courage. You know why I need courage? Because my faith isn't perfect. You know what the next question is? How much do I get? Well, I'll tell you what I want. I want lots. You know what I get? Just enough. when we were talking before this meeting, and they said, how do you feel about this? And I said, well, it's a lot like writing inventory. You just go do it. You know, that's the way I feel about that. But sometimes you just go do it, and sometimes I only have enough courage to get my one foot in front of the other. But getting one foot in front of the other has got me through this program. You know, when I had to go make amends to some of these people that I had cheated or beat up, I sure didn't want to be there. And it took every bit of courage that God could give me to get there. And I never knew I had that kind of courage until I got one foot out. And I have to walk through my fear to find spirituality in this program, and I'm inclined to believe that you do too. There, God either is or he isn't. He's either everything or he's nothing. Before I came up here, I had absolutely no idea what I was going to say. I'm as surprised at this as you are. I was kind of curious about what the message was this morning. I'm still kind of curious. There's a thing that is euphemistically called a sex inventory. It really has to do with relationships. Where was I selfish and self-seeking? Where did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Same thing with everything else. You just answer all the questions. What I found in that was that I had been selfish and self-seeking in every relationship I ever had, and no wonder they didn't work. And on the end of that, my sponsor told me to put something that we call take it to the grave stuff. Usually has something to do with sex. So I wrote down everything I was ashamed of on the end of that inventory, and I went to talk to him. Well, my sponsor, and some of you know him, his name is Don P., sat down with me, and the word risk is coming up again. Don Pritz is the only guy that I had ever let close to me. And when I sat down with that pile of garbage, I knew that he was going to get up and say, you really are a nasty person. And that he would never talk to me again, and the person that I had allowed close to me would leave me like I was an old sack of trash. And my attitude about this program is that God either is or he isn't. The spiritual life is not a theory, so you just do it. So I did it. And at the end of that inventory, he stood up and threw his arms around me and said, I love you. And I am so happy that you did that. And I learned a couple things about that. One of them is that as bad as I was at that point in time, that someone could love me. And I didn't care that it was a man. And the other thing was that I can't remember what the other thing was. You know, one of the things that happens when you drink too long is that there's a big hole in here. It's like a piece of Swiss cheese. It's like a black hole. And every once in a while, something falls in there, and it never comes out again. I never had to be anything again for you that I wasn't. What a freedom. You know, you just get to see Bob Olson up here. I don't have to be anything more or anything less than I am today for you, and it's all right. It doesn't mean all of you have to like it. It just means that that's what it is. And I do not have to run around sticking all this stuff up, all these personas in front of me anymore, so you can't see who I am. This is who I am. I went home, did what the book says. In fact, it says taking the book down from the shelf. So I went home, put it on the shelf, So you might notice that I am just slightly dogmatic about this program. I am a fundamentalist at heart. I have always been that way. Took the book down from the shelf. I reviewed the first five proposals to see whether I had not made cement out of sand or mortar out of sand or whatever that says. And then I took a look at the sixth step and asked for the willingness to be rid of all those things which have kept me from the sunlight of the Spirit. And then I went and did the seven-step prayer. God, I'm now ready that you have all me good and bad. The book says that we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. The next line in the book is, we did it when we took inventory. Okay? My amends list was my inventory list. I had to add a couple things on there, but by and large, almost everything, every person I had to see to make amends to was on my inventory. Was that ever neat? I mean, I did a lot of that work without even knowing it. And so I went through this thing. We do a thing there where I had the amends list, and I went over to Don, and I said, well, okay, now, how do I manage this? And he said, you know, what you need to do is you need to go through that list, and you have to write down the harm, okay? Write down the harm in every one of those, and so you know what you're making amends for. Because if you're just going out there and going, I really know I did something bad to you, but I'm not sure what it was, that's not a very effective way to do that. So write down the harm, and then we'll talk about how to do that. And you need to keep the other person foremost in mind that you're not going to harm them by any further by doing this to them. So I went through this whole thing, and I had a pile of financial amends. I think I owed $15,000. And when it got down to my dad, actually, you know, 15 years ago, $15,000. It, for me, was, you know, you don't just, that stuff doesn't grow on trees. When it got down to my dad, I said, well, look, my dad's in this army home up here, and he can't talk, and he's not supposed to be capable of any kind of continuous thought or anything. So I know that I've harmed him. I found out that I'd harmed him by holding him at arm's length my whole life because of his alcoholism. I never tried to understand that. All I wanted was him away from me. And I didn't like him. I just didn't want to be around him. I just, he was every bad thing in my life. And I found out he wasn't every bad thing in my life, and that he was reacting to his alcoholism, and all the chaos that he provided in my life was because of his alcoholism. And, you know, I met guys that knew him before he was really a bad drunk, and they said, your dad is one of the nicest guys you'd ever meet until he drank. Same thing they said about me. And I said, but I don't have to go make amends to him because he wouldn't understand. And Don said, well, you know, you'd weasel out of that just like you weasel out of every other damn thing in your life. This says that you go off and clean off your side of the street, and it makes absolutely no difference whether he understands or he doesn't. So just get in your car, go to Wisconsin, and make amends to him. So I did that. And I went to the Grand Army home in King, Wisconsin, and I walked in there, and here's this little old man that I hadn't seen in about 10 years in a wheelchair, sort of parked in the corner. And I went up to him, and I said, hi, I'm your son, Bob. And he kind of looked up, and what they were telling me wasn't the truth. You know, he understood. I could see that. And I said, I need to talk about some stuff with you. And I took him off in this room. I wheeled him in there, and I said, I need to make amends to you because I have caused harm in your life. And the harm that I've caused you is that I did not understand your alcoholism. I didn't know you had to do that stuff. I just didn't understand your alcoholism until it was our alcoholism. and I regret having done that. And I am willing to do anything that I need to do to balance the books. And he understood that. You know, when I told him that I was drunk, he got real sad. He'd been a drunk all his life. The only reason why he wasn't drinking there is because he couldn't get out of his wheelchair to drink. And he knew all the anguish and all the pain and all the fear and all the bullshit that we feel because we're alcoholics. And he was very sad about it. And I told him that I had quit and that I had found the solution. Part of the solution was to come and talk to him about what I needed to do to balance the books. And he became very excited and very animated. And I thank God I did that. I went to his brother, an entirely different kind of person, who didn't drink a whole lot, had been, was the officer in a bank all his life and everything. His name's Leif. I went to my Uncle Leif and I said, "I'm in trouble financially, Leif." And he said, "Well, what's the problem?" And I showed it to him and he said, "How'd you get that far in?" And I said, "Well, I'm an alcoholic. And it just took that to keep going. Now, how do I get out of it?" And he said, "Well, it's fairly simple. You just start paying now and you pay till it's done." So, you know, it's just like an AA, "Wait a minute, do you have another solution?" So I did that. I started paying, and I paid for 3.5 years, just paid like 30% of my paycheck every payday. Hardly ever went out, hardly ever went to a movie, hardly ever went out for dinner. Just paid, thinking maybe something would happen. And in a move that was uncharacteristic to me, after 3.5 years, I took my kids to a boat show in Denver, because I've always been crazy about boats. Never had one. You know, I was one of those kids that sit on the shore and watch everybody else's boats and go, "Boy, when I grow up, I'm going to have one of those." So I went to this boat show. We were walking around. The Bassmasters were up there, and they were had a raffle on a boat, 3 chances for $10. And I tell you, this guy had $10 of my money before I even knew I had it out of my pocket. And I'm going, "Oh, my God. How could I do something that stupid? I mean, I just gave these guys money, and I don't even like bass fishing." And the next day, they called me up and told me I won the boat. Well, see, I still owed $2,500. I'd been down at York Street, which is kind of the mother house in Denver, right? It's a big clubhouse. And I'd been down there going, "Well, no, I've been paying my amends for 3.5 years now. I've been doing such a good job. I think God just loves me to pieces. You know, I just did all this by myself." I went out to the store where they had this boat, and I was talking to the wholesaler, and I said, "How much is that boat worth?" And he said, $2,400. And my kids were with me. And they were crawling around in this boat going, "Gee, Dad, this is just great. Is this going to be our boat?" And I said, "No. No, it's not." Just a Texan came up to me and he said, "You want to sell that boat, son?" And I said, "How much?" And he said, "I'll give you $2,500 for it." And I said, "Cash?" And he said, "I'll meet you at the bank tomorrow morning." I met him at the bank the next morning, and he gave me $2,500 bills, as Texans are wont to do. And I paid off the rest of my amends. You know, I was over there being such a big damn deal, talking about what a great job I had done. And this big hand came out of the sky with the rest of my amends money and said, "Who? Who? God works like that in my life. He works that way in your life, too, if you want him to. You know, God never, I just don't think there's a free lunch. I'm sure there is somewhere, But you know, all God's ever wanted me to do was show some degree of willingness that I was willing to participate in this program. That's all. Ken says, continue to watch. You know, there's the steps that we read on the wall, and then there's the instructions. And the instructions for the 10 steps says, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And when you see it, ask God to remove it immediately. Talk to someone about it, and if you've harmed someone, make amends to them. And then turn your thoughts to someone you can help. Actually, it says turn your thoughts something. It's like vigorously. I can't remember the word. And you know what the beauty is in that? The beauty is turning your thoughts. You know, my problem, I don't care what step I'm on, my problem is still that I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. And that my problem is that I turn inward instead of outward. And one of the great things that you can learn in this program is turning your thoughts, resolutely is the term, by the way, resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. Because when I'm thinking about you, I'm not thinking about me. One of the greatest things and one of the most difficult things in this program for me has been step 11. And the reason why is because step 11 has to do with discipline. It talks about it. In this way, God disciplined us. I don't know why people don't do this, because there is so much benefit in there. And I will tell you about it. And if you're not doing it, I hope to God you do it, because there is so much that you can gain. Don't walk around in this program with half a loaf of bread. Just too much available. And maybe the only reason why I'm down here is to show you pieces of that loaf. It says when we go to bed at night, we review our day and we look to see where we were selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid. It asks us questions about how we treated other people and whether we put more into the day than we took out. And after we've made that review, it asks us to ask God for forgiveness for those things that we've done, and to give us some direction the next day. And I do that when I go to bed at night. So it's upon retiring, and upon my retiring, I do that. And when I get up in the morning, it says upon awakening. And what I do then is I do exactly what the book does. You know, all I've been doing all this time is just answering the questions. God, please keep my day divorced from selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. Please give me inspiration, intuitive thought, or decision. And then I plan my day. Well, I'm going to get up today, I'm going to take a shower, and I'm going to get dressed and have breakfast, and I'll go out and talk to some of the people out here in the atrium. And then I'm going to go back to my room, and I'm going to get right with God, and I'm going to get my suit on so I look good for these folks, and I'm going to go up and tell them whatever it is you want me to say. And then when that's done, I'm going to go spend the afternoon with a really neat gentleman that I met down here, and then I'm going to get on a plane, go home and see my wife. And I'm going to go to bed early tonight, and I'm going to get up tomorrow and go to work. And it says, God, please show me all through the day what my next step is to be. And please give me whatever I need to take care of the problems. I ask especially for freedom from self-will and make no request for myself only. Okay, and then I pray for all the people I love. And then I say the third step prayer, and then I came over here to talk. Okay. It says I have to maintain attitudes through the day. My attitudes are thy will, not mine be done, and I'm not running the show anymore. That's part of the 11th step. And it says I should pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. Try that. You know, when you're agitated or doubtful, back up two steps. Say, wait a minute, God. I think I just stepped into something I don't understand. Please show me what's going on here. Please give me the right thought or action. That's discipline. That's the kind of discipline that I have to learn, because I am an undisciplined, out-of-control alcoholic. And left to my own devices, I will wind up face down in my own puke in a gutter someplace. And I don't want to live like that. Carry these messages to alcoholics. You know who I, 12 step, Every once in a while I get a new drunk, but that's not the kind of person I attract. I attract people in this program who don't have a solution. You know, if you've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while, and I don't care if it's a day, a week, a year, 20 years, you haven't found a solution that's in the book, and the problem hasn't changed, and the solution hasn't changed. And when you're ready to go on a spiritual adventure, Alcoholics Anonymous is ready for you to go on it. And how do I practice these principles in all my affairs? I just keep doing it over and over again. If you want what I have, and I have everything I've ever wanted, and you're willing to do what I did, you can have it. Thank you.